Welcome, Patreons, to the temporarily paywalled continuation of the main feed interview of episode 6, A Dare Wrapped in a Joke, Wrapped in a Void with Cy Cantarell. I'm really grateful for your support, and I hope this project brings some joy and hope and utility to your works and days. And just want to reiterate that my plan is to review and maybe reflect a little beforehand on what I learned in the part one parts of these interviews, and then roll the rest of the conversation and then return with some further reflections. Because Cy Cantarell's studies are so compressed, I thought it would be worth just listing the main points of my interview with her before rolling part two. So I've got 8 quotes here that I'll quickly summarize. First, what looks like politics is often subculture. What looks like a manifesto is sometimes a dare wrapped in a joke, wrapped in a void. Okay, so this is the key, you know, this is the viral aphorism. This is why I titled the episode Why I Did. And it's really Cantarell's take on how online extremism hides behind layers of irony and coded humor, that political meaning and nihilistic play can become indistinguishable. But the important thing to remember is that the irony and coded humor can also just be what it is. It can be hiding nothing but disillusionment. Now, in the vein of who does and doesn't get the jokes or the jargon in an event like the Charlie Kirk assassination and the details that emerge around Tyler Robinson, Cantarell says, quote, humans are always drawing lines between who belongs and who doesn't, and those lines are what make both fringe and dominant cultures tick. So she reframes belonging and exclusion as universal social dynamics, not fringe phenomena. And I think this shows that fascist movements exploit this same need for identity. Now, some really good advice that comes from Cantarell, especially for me as a culture observer, quote, trying to decode memes one by one misses the point. It's like dissecting the punchline of a joke. The meaning lives in who laughs. So there's an overly confident or sometimes dogged gumshoe, I'm going to get my answers attitude that can guide the technocratic analysis of online radicalism. But understanding intentions and motives requires knowing the audience and cultural context, not just the content. All right, next quote. Quote, irony isn't always a recruitment plan. It's a current that pulls people along. Most don't set out to radicalize. They drift there. So this is an approach to narratives about radicalization. And Cantarell's point is that subcultures operate more like gravity than strategy. And I think that's a little bit more of a forgiving picture of radicalization, because, you know, it suggests that conditions around that person could also change socially in order for a redirection to happen. Now, on the question of how to interpret or categorize contradictory political actors, Cantarell says, quote, fringe ideologies often fuse contradictions as proof of purity, and that's how we get neo-Nazi trans people. This is not logic. It's about belonging. And so she exposes how extremist identity formation rewards paradox and incoherence as demonstrations of loyalty, but also unique loyalty. Now, on the topic of men, Cantarell says, men in isolation become prey to meaninglessness, despair, and rage, not because they're men, but because we give everyone in these conditions nowhere to belong. So this is a social psychology analysis of how alienation, not ideology, primes vulnerable men for extremist or nihilist worldviews. And then finally, people use racism, sexism, and irony as anxiety management systems. And so this, I find, is a psychological frame that's very interesting, that reactionary expressions often function as emotional regulation rather than ideological conviction. And I think that's really worth keeping in mind, especially if we're thinking about young people whose views may not be as fixed as they seem to be. So in all of these cases, I think that what Cantarell is offering is a kind of way of thinking about the you know, abstract and archetypal young person who is on the edge of the alt-right pipeline online, and how it isn't necessarily a foregone conclusion that they're going to be sucked all the way in. It really depends on how many other social factors are going on around them in their lives. So here we go with part two, picking up with my questions about Graham Plattner. I've got two other questions in this kind of grouping of, you know, what does the Plattner story expose? And one is this feeling of that I think a lot of people run up against, which is, well, you know, does my brother or my son or my cousin actually have noxious views that they otherwise hide? Like, do they code switch when they're at home or in their communities? Like, what do they really think? And it seems like, you know, the some of the online culture that we think most about really operates to increase that sort of paradox.
Yes, and likely, I mean, we all have biases and we all have to constantly interrogate our positions, I think. I would say that because there's such a plethora of this content, of this red pill content out there now, there are probably quite a lot of people who have been exposed to it and may resonate with it for usually reasons of, again, metastasizing and reconstituted like grief and anger. And so, because you want to have a place to put those feelings, you don't know how to, I mean, no one is taught, you know, at this point in time, we should have courses on this, but how to deal with discomfort and how to deal with the confrontation with ambiguity. And so I do think that people use irony, nihilism, and racism, sexism, all of those things as anxiety management systems, and our larger systemic issues. We have larger systemic issues with that as well, that it's baked into the system. So yes, I would say most people probably do have some controversial, if not outright noxious beliefs that they may not want to pull that joke out in mixed company, right? But they may pull that joke out in, you know, like we saw with the recent Young Republican text message group.
Exactly, right.
And it's important to recognize that and to recognize the divide between what might be a more private identity and a public identity. And it really just shows how deeply in the groundwater these views are. I mean, these are things that have been with us from the beginning. And I think part of American exceptionalism has been the denial of that narrative.
Right.
And we see that even more actively now with the administration trying to pull back on, you know, historical representations of slavery and things like that. We have a very, very dark history. I live in New Orleans. I confront that every single day. And so I think it's that denial is a huge part of why also these narratives, I think, become so magnetic to people.
So we'll turn to identity in a moment. But the last question in my list here of, you know, anxious provocations is this question of, like, if my brother, my son, my cousin, my neighbor had fascist views at some point, can they turn themselves around? And I think that is at the center of what's happening with Graham Plattner right now is, you know, can you be an edgelord? Can you shitpost and can you change?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. I mean, anyone can change, right? Like, not maybe from, there are some caveats. I think people who suffer from or with certain types of personality disorders, like malignant narcissism, like Donald Trump, I don't think he has any capacity to change. I think people, as they age too, they tend to get a little bit more ossified, and it's very difficult to have that kind of fundamental conversation with oneself and really incorporate all of the changes that are required. But in Plattner's case, let's say, I think it looks like, And again, I don't know him. I don't know if this could be completely inaccurate. He could be hiding a lot more. It's totally possible.
Exactly.
It's possible for someone to have had poorly informed and offensive positions at one point and to have done very stupid things and to come back from that and say, that is not who I want to be. I do think that's possible.
So we were emailing before meeting, and in discussing Plattner a little bit, you really homed in on the problem of identity. and especially online identity, and the question of like, who is Graham Plattner, really is a narrative. It is a story. Can you unpack the narrative of who is Graham Plattner really, or, you know, how that's always a narrative question?
Narrative is essentially how the human brain, it's the organizing principle for the human brain. It's how we make sense of the world. We cannot not make a story in order to understand some aspect of what we are trying to incorporate into our own lived experience. And so when we ask who is Graham Plattner, or who is, you know, who am I, right? Who is my significant other or my family? A lot of this is about, you know, is it the actions that I take, that I choose to take? Is it who I see myself to be? Or is it the perception of those actions and that presentation by others? And so that's where you get into this like very ambiguous space where it's a little bit like, you know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's like, for me, I might be able to look at a series of those things, whether it's how he, Graham Plattner, represents himself, the choices that he's made in his life. And then I'm going to take that and make an interpretation that is based on what my, you know, the same series of things for me, like how much do I incorporate who I think he is into my own self-concept? And this is why for followers of Donald Trump too, like the story, the narrative that they have created about this person, they have incorporated into their own self-concept, which is why when that narrative is threatened, they feel threatened. And so I think this gets into just, again, how humans form meaningful connections to one another, and culture as a whole being a narrative process, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. And so I don't think it's really possible to understand the sum of anyone, right? I don't know who I am fully. And so like, how could I say that about anybody right. else? Any interpretation I make is always going to be based on my own lived experience and what I might want to believe about that person. So I think this is, you know, and I'd written in our email that this also comes into the fore when we're talking about Taylor Swift and her recent controversies, because this new album that she put out has kind of rewritten some of her fans' interpretation of who they thought she was, and thereby called into question their own self-identity. And that has caused a lot of consternation. And so I think we're just seeing something similar there.
Maybe one question I have about the usage of the term narrative is, does it promote or discourage ambiguity? I think the way we're talking about it is that a certain sort of picture or impression of the person forms very sort of concretely, and then that's very hard to challenge. It becomes painful for the follower to actually question it. But I mean, when I hear the word narrative, I also think of a storyline over time in which a person might change. And I'm wondering if there's a distinction to make there. Do narratives promote or discourage ambiguity?
I think it depends on the context. And, you know, this is gets at one of the core beliefs that I have about humans, which is that we tend to shy away from ambiguity. You know, Sartre even said like there's the horror of the ambiguous, because it causes us to confront the blind spots in ourselves and to experience our own anxiety in the face of the unknown and then decide what to do with that anxiety. That's a huge cognitive load.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think, you know, you look at novels with an unreliable narrator, and there's some people who just won't read novels that have things like that because you don't want to be, you know, misled, you know, by the person who's telling you the story or is interpreting reality for you. And so I think like in certain contexts, ambiguity can be seen as a maybe more, quote, sophisticated version of narrative, like that we use ambiguous narratives to try to confront certain aspects of our own anxiety and fear. But in contexts like politics, people don't want an ambiguous narrative in politics.
Right.
That is something where people want a very clear-cut, very, like a hero's journey, right? Which is why the Plattner
right.
trajectory is getting all messed up, because it turns out he's an unreliable, flawed hero.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because from one point of view, his narrative over that longer, more ambiguous sort of pathway should be everything that the populist-minded Democrat is yearning for. But from another point of view, you know, sort of fixed in space or time and pinned to Reddit, the associations with him are just cursed on its face. So yeah, the desire for clarity is certainly foiled by what's been reported.
In a way too, it's like he specifically is such an interesting case because he has the archetype, or he's attached himself to the archetype. And we could again say, I don't know if this is unconscious, I don't know if this is conscious, but like the white working man's hero, right?
Right.
The type of people who would have been out there in the front lines in the 60s and 70s striking and on the picket lines, and maybe would have been a union head during that time period. And that is an archetype that's by and large fairly devoid of any contemporary, I won't say relevance, but it is not maybe the most contemporary interpretation of what is needed. And so it's interesting that he's invoking things that are a bit nostalgic. And none of, you know, all of those people were also probably much more imperfect than what we remember, because there's just so much more data about everybody out there. I just wonder too, whether, like, looking at Mamdani, for instance, versus Plattner, right? The difference in those two can tell us a lot about sort of the next generation's version of that archetype versus maybe the previous generation's version of that archetype.
Do you see more coherence in the way Mamdani has presented himself and been received by his general following?
I think so. I mean, that's just my interpretation again too. And Mamdani also has the curse and the gift of being much younger and have been maybe more aware at a younger age of what he wanted to do in a way that maybe Obama also was, and so could sort of stay very clean as an archetype. I mean, who knows, maybe there's something that someone will uncover about him too, but and no one is perfect, right? This is something else that I just want to stress, like no one is perfect, right? I mean, we think back to Clinton, who was like an incredibly imperfect, kind of terrible person, frankly, and had all of these like tensions in his character. And, you know, but the big deal that it was when he revealed that he had smoked marijuana a few times, you know, right? So.
Yeah, shock and horror.
Right?
Yeah. Never mind dismantling the welfare state. Never mind, like, you know, Middle East policy. Like, if
yeah, or rampant sexual abuse or like anything else. So it's, I think it's, the archetypes of what is like part of the hero is, or heroine, right? It changes with what our expectations, with the cultural narratives of the time. And I sort of feel like Plattner is coming out of a little bit of an older version of that narrative. And so some of this past that is catching up with him, let's say, are also the ghosts of an earlier generation as well.
You know, one distinction to make that I've just thought about in listening to you between Mamdani and Plattner is that Mamdani's unacceptable or intolerable statements in the past are not made anonymously. Mm-hmm. They're not buried on Reddit. He's sitting there in Zoom calls or sometimes in interviews saying, yeah, we have to seize the means of production. Mm-hmm. And and so there isn't as much mystery, I think, around well, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting that Plattner's Dark Night of the Soul really happens, it seems, in this space that is so contested and so difficult to suss out.
Well, it's liminal.
You're looking into every day. Yeah, it's liminal.
You know, and I think that also, you know, I think the Plattner archetype is somebody who would make a great novel. A great novel.
Oh, incredible. That's the first thing I said.
Yeah.
Was oh my gosh, this is going to go farther and farther and farther, and we have no idea where it's going to wind up.
Right.
And that's a great novel.
But it's like, I don't know if he's going to make a great politician. Right?
Yeah,
there's just that. And I am like the last person who would also make a great politician. there, like, that has never been something that I have wanted with every iota of my being. Like, I do not want to be in politics. But I mean, the person who is attracted to politics in the first place becomes their own, like that already is attracting a certain host of associations, right? And so you sort of have to look at that person with a little bit of a different eye. And so I just think that's something we have to think about too.
Well, neither of us are psychologists or psychotherapists, mm-hmm. but I think what we're both maybe, because I agree with you on this, I think one of the things that this brings out is the person who wants to be on stage like Plattner and who knows somewhere that that Reddit history is in his past and that the tattoo is on his chest, like he's asking for some kind of conflict. There's a drive towards overcoming something that is in the shadows, perhaps, you know, or hopefully without facing it.
And I think it's not even just that conflict. It's the hubristic impulse, right?
Yeah.
It's daring the gods a little bit.
Right.
And I think that is an interesting, again, that's a characterological fascination. But again, I don't know if that makes for a great public servant. Do we want our public servants to be, you know, consistent and show up day after day and be sort of like slightly boring functionaries, but at least they're staying on message, and maybe that message is more inspiring to a larger host of people given the macro conditions of the world right now? I kind of argue maybe yes. Like, we need that consistency. We don't need complexity right now.
If we need consistency, it would be great if that consistency could also carry with it this history that he's brought, apparently, which is, oh, I saw firsthand what it was to be at the center of American empire with a gun in my hand.
Yeah.
And I am against that. And that's not going to happen anymore if I have anything to say about it, right? Like, it would be great if those two things could come together. But with wisdom born out of trauma, it's going to be hard to find, I think.
And, you know, again, I could be totally wrong about all of this, and he would make a great public servant and, you know, but countering the military industrial complex and the surveillance industrial complex at this point, that personal realization of being kind of the still point of the turning world at which you're there with the gun in your hand, pointing it at somebody and saying never again. I mean, that is again, a very narratively inspiring moment.
Right.
But in order to turn around and apply that realization to a systemic issue that's as deep and global as the defense industry is another thing entirely. And I would want to see a policy platform that is actually turning that into policy, because I think that is the thorny point.
You know, it's so interesting, just as a side note, what you're describing in terms of like these historically different paradigms comes up for me all the time, because I fetishize the images and the literature of past anti-fascist movements in a very like strong way. And some of my favorite stories in the entire world come out of the International Brigades gathering in 1936, you know, and sailing to Spain as civilians. And I'm like, wow, that's so incredible. And I see that kind of replicated again energetically by the Global Samud Flotilla. And I think that that's very impressive. And I also know that there is no universe in which a civilian can sort of hitchhike their way to Spain and then pick up a bolt action rifle and fight the enemy. That doesn't exist anymore. And I have to adjust all of my sort of expectations of justice accordingly.
The revolutionary as an archetype is sort of the 20th and 21st century romantic ideal,
yeah.
Right? Because we are surrounded by these systems that are so big and so opaque and so human, like inhuman,
right?
That the revolutionary becomes the avatar for systemic change in our stories. I mean, this goes back to even Hemingway going and fighting
exactly.
in the Spanish Civil War.
Right, exactly. You know,
it's like,
yeah.
But ultimately, yeah, it's like that sort of central domino that causes an entire empire to fall. I mean, The Matrix is also based on that, right? Like this is this epic story of the alienated individual that's actually the key to the undoing of the inhuman system.
Right.
And of course we all want to believe in that. Of course we do. But I think it does get dangerous when it actually butts up against policy.
Or reality, because I think in all honesty, the answer to Peter Thiel is not Che Guevara on the motorcycle, right? Like, right. These are two different things entirely in terms of the concentration of power and money and, you know, surveillance and control. Like, the notion of physical force itself or resistance has fundamentally changed in ways that are very difficult to understand.
And I think, you know, the answer to Peter Thiel being, you know, better tax policy is like not something that you're going to get a feature length film out of.
No, you're not. It's not. It's not going to go on Netflix. So last question. Thank you so much for your time, Sai. I want to ask that if you could imagine yourself into 2025 as the 14-year-old you were, this is impossible, but if you give it a shot, what skills and supports would you hope to have as you navigate life and online life so that, you know, you would hopefully come to the kind of rich and nuanced understanding of human psychology online and off that you've got? Like, what advice would you give to yourself?
This was a hard one for me. I think because I naturally gravitated toward, I had a nihilistic streak. As a young person, absolutely. And I think if I could go back and offer something to myself at that age, it would be to validate that the things that I saw and continue to see are not crazy. And there are like a lot of the population of people do go around pretending that everything is fine and pretending that they are happy when in fact they are not. And that the environment itself at this point is toxic. And the fact that you feel really out of place and gross in a big box store is not your fault.
Right.
But also to recognize that in knowing that kind of nobody knows what they're doing, that a lot of people are subscribing to these narratives because there are no other narratives available, that it's going to take a lot of work in order to uncover the path through a pathless territory, right? And you're not going to find that by looking at somebody, of what somebody's buying and buying the same things that they are. You're not going to look at that by looking at somebody who has millions and millions of followers on a platform and trying to emulate that. It is not going to be the way that you're going to get to yourself. Like, I think that's the heart. And there is no just neat packaged version of what it is to become an individual and to interact with meaning on a daily level. It is a process. You never resolve at it.
Are you saying that to be nihilistic is to sort of forget that the process is ongoing, that if you were to speak to yourself as that 14-year-old, you would say, hey, you know, this might not make you feel better entirely, but everybody is full of shit and everybody's trying to figure it out, because nihilism is the foreclosure on the possibility that something else could grow, or maybe this feeling that, well, things are shitty as they are and everybody just wants it to be that way.
There's a huge component of both nihilism and eternalism. If we look at this as a polarity, like that sort of, I'm with David Chapman on this. He's like a philosopher who has published his book Meaningness as a hypertext book. And I recommend that to anybody. It's free. But he sees this as a polarity between eternalism and nihilism, and nihilism being that nothing matters and eternalism is that everything matters.
Right.
And it sort of resolves to the same place. Even if you have folks like the Christian nationalists or eternalists, and they're saying like this version of God's will, et cetera, is the only thing that matters and everything is subjugated to it. And the nihilists, you know, the Tyler Robinsons, let's say, theoretically, are the people who are saying, well, nothing matters. We just need to burn everything down and dance in the flames as the world goes up.
Right.
And I think both of those things negate and also abrogate responsibility to something else, right? And the responsibility is for everybody to stand in that place where meaning and purpose sort of come and go, and it appears and it disappears. Or Chapman would say it's patterned and nebulous. So, and you have to be willing to face and be present with the anxiety that ambiguity provokes. And that is the absolute hardest thing for humans to do. And that is what both of these narratives foreclose.
Sai Cantarell, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate your work.
Thank you, Matthew. It was a joy.
So a few weeks ago, I took our eldest downtown on his 13th birthday to hang out in the Annex, which is the old U of T kind of residential rooming house core. And we stopped in at the Anti-Capitalist Book Fair at the old Transat Club. Now, this place opened in 1965 as a club for Australian and Kiwi expats. It's been a folky coffee house, a fringe theater spot, and grungy jazz and punk venue, often all at the same time. It's also the home of the Toronto Zine Library. It's this low-slung kind of rabbit warren of a building, and walking through it, I remembered the dozens of shows and poetry readings and even little plays I was in that space back in the early 90s. And I actually remember going to this very book fair back then. It probably had a different name. There have probably been a number of ferocious schisms within the planning committees for this book fair over the years, but here they are still. On the Transact website today, they say they host 1,400 events per year. And I suppose that doing that and scratching out tiny rental fees from each is how they've survived the gentrification that has eaten up most other third or transitional or hangout spaces like this, especially in this really beautiful part of town. So this club, for me, was a fully offline space in my memory and body. And on this recent October day, therefore, the groups who were gathered in the various rooms brought all of that back, from the Celtic music jam session in the bar to the 50-odd booksellers in the low auditorium space. Now, my son made a beeline for the art books at the Between the Lines press table. This has been open and cooperatively owned since 1977, Between the Lines Press. We picked up a beautiful book called The Art of Solidarity and another book on anarchist art through the years. And then I stopped in at the Democratic Socialists of Canada table to ask when their meetings were. A few tables over from them was the Revolutionary Communists of Canada. And then beside them was an anarchist collective selling zines and artwork. And these are factions that compete and argue with each other. They have a long history of debate and struggle as they theorize and experiment with different social forms and argue over theories of change and the signs of revolution. But here they all were under the same roof on a Sunday afternoon. And from table to table, I knew that the language and ideas and values were all going to share the same general dialect, the same set of values, the same epistemology. And how about the mood? Well, it was serious, but not dour. People sharing the same vision can generate a cheerfully somber buzz in a room if they're doing something all together, and that's what it felt like. There were some tables with print newspapers that had very large headlines where the focus was on, you know, one catastrophe and urgency over another related to many different issues, and rightfully so. But none of that really slipped into any nihilism that I could feel in the room, and I have a good radar for that. I also didn't feel any sense of hipster irony in the room. It felt like everyone was saying what they wanted to say directly. And I bring this all up, obviously, because the political internet feels so different from this. I mean, first of all, we know it can be disembodied and populated by anonymous actors and disrupted by bots and accelerated by echo chambers and algorithms. And also, it is a culture scrambler. Our online politics is happening in the same flattened space as our social media, our gaming, our streaming shows, banking, and porn. I actually remember Amber A. Lee Frost remarking on a Chapo Trap House episode once that you really don't want to do your politics through the same box you use for online gambling. Now, back in the early 90s, it might have even been the late 80s, when I came to this same book fair in this same club, this building was also a multi-purpose space, as it is now. It was a library, a pub, a music venue, a theater. But it wasn't flattened on a screen. It wasn't in my pocket. It didn't sit on my desk. Somehow, those categories of human experience didn't collapse into each other. They were interwoven, but not an amorphous clump. And of course, all of this is disquieting for me. But the future isn't written. And it would be easy as a pre-digital guy who has washed up on the shores of the internet to feel that the Transact Club and other third spaces are under relentless assault, that they won't exist in a few years because young people like my own kids won't sufficiently know what they are to care about or nurture them. And so what will they have beyond their screens? But I really have to own that as my fear, that as a 53-year-old given to melancholy over the past, these feelings are about my own vulnerability, my own death, as much as anything that is real and pressing for my kids. Because if I pay close attention to the actual kids around me, not the kids I invent to exercise my worries, they are never completely sidelined or buried in their screened worlds. They are not allowing nature to wither around them. For them, there may be more fluidity between on and offline worlds, but this doesn't mean that they are not fully here and alive and able to learn how to use this technology as opposed to having it use them. My kid that day was fully immersed in this celebration of books, and then we walked out into the fall day and grabbed an outdoor table at Futures Bakery right next door for a cup of coffee, and we thumbed through the books. And then he said, reaching for his phone, "Dad, I want to show you this meme." And everything felt like it was one continuous thing, one continuous life. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care of each other.